Well, good evening, everybody. I'm Anthony Giddens, a former director of the London School of Economics, and it's my pleasure to welcome everyone here this evening, and particularly to welcome our special guest, Harvey Solana, who I'm very proud to call a friend as well as a distinguished, highly distinguished political intellectual colleague. Harvey Solana himself began as an academic, a professor of solid state physics. He joined the Spanish Socialist Party. He held a wide range of ministerial posts in Spain before becoming the Secretary General of NATO in December 1995. Subsequently, because he's had such a stellar career that I'm not going to go through many details, subsequently he became the foreign policy voice of the European Union when he was appointed EU High Representative for Common Foreign and Security Policy. Dr. Solana and the rest of us here tonight are here to discuss this report, A Human Security Doctrine for Europe. Each of the panelists here, with the exception of Javier Solana, is a contributor to this document, but Javier Solana is the inspiration of this document. So his influence is, as you might say, all-pervasive within it. I'd like to congratulate the centre as well as the participants for producing the document, which is on such an important issue, as everybody knows. And I think as the participants talk about it, you will see that Mary and her colleagues, of whom I was one notionally, even though I wasn't able to attend many of the sessions, have produced a distinctive, original, and really challenging approach to European security in an age where the military capability of Europe, the geopolitical role of Europe, these things surely need advancing, but perhaps in a different sense from the ones that have ordinarily been understood. Now, the format of this evening, there's a panel of three people who will speak first, followed by Javier Solana, who will speak last. The three other panelists, if I can introduce them to you, are all connected to the Center for Global... Well, no, sorry, connected to the London School of Economics. Mary Calder is Professor of Global Governance and Director of the Center for the Study of Global Governance. Christine Chinkin is Professor, who sits in the middle there, is Professor of International Law at the school. Pavel Saifta is a fellow at the Center again for Global Governance and was formerly Czech ambassador to the UK over the years 1997 to 2003. And this is the format. Mary apparently has nobbled herself 10 to 15 minutes. Christine only gets 5. This is Global Governance in Action. Pavel only gets 5. But given his role in world affairs, I figure Javier Solana can speak for as long as he likes, more or less. So I hope everyone has an enjoyable and stimulating evening. After the panelists have spoken, there will, of course, be a period of question and answer in the audience, and there should be roving mics both down the bottom and up in the top tier to facilitate this process. So I'm going to wend my way back to my seat, and Mary is going to explain the background and structure of this Barcelona study group document.
Can I just...
Why don't you give Javier Solana a big clap and a big LSE welcome? More, come on.
Can't say how grateful I am to Javier Solana for coming here today. I actually wanted him. Oh, can you hear now?
No.
No. What about this one? Is that better? Oh, I'm looking at the wrong one. So I said I'm very, very grateful to Javier Solana that he came here today, and I really wanted him to speak first, but he was too modest and insisted that he would prefer to speak last. And I also want to thank him because he did such a lot to make this report a reality. Actually, it was conceived at a lunch after his conversation with Tony Giddens here at LSE. And he's really taken an interest, proposed people, ideas all the way through. So it's been a very rewarding process. So what I'm going to do is very briefly give you some pointers. I can't tell you everything in 10 minutes to what the report's about and what's in it. And I'll leave some bits for Christine and Pavel. What we were asked to do by Javier Solana was to produce a report on European security capabilities. The context for this report is that over the last few years, there's been a new focus on European security and defense policy. And this started even before 9/11. But I think it's speeded up and accelerated, and a lot is due to the efforts made by Javier Solana. Troops have been made available and civilian capabilities under something called the Headline Goals. We now have autonomous EU missions in places like Bosnia, Macedonia. We had the operation in Eastern Congo. And last December, I think particularly significantly, the European Council agreed to the establishment of an autonomous defense agency, to a civil military planning cell under Javier Solana, and probably most importantly, to a new European security strategy. And I do think that the European security strategy does mark a distinctive European approach to security. It's very different. It's quite a contrast, for example, to Bush's national security strategy. And two key ideas in that is one is preventive engagement, trying to get involved before conflicts break out. And the other, which I think is very crucial, is tough multilateralism. Yes, we're multilateralists in Europe. Yes, we want to work through the UN, but we want to make this effective and serious and not just something that's on paper. So what our report was doing really was taking that a stage further and thinking, what kind of security capabilities would Europe need if the security strategy is to be implemented? The European security strategy identified five threats: weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, organized crime, regional conflicts, and failing states. And we've actually focused on regional conflicts and failing states because, in a sense, all of these other threats actually breed in the black holes that are created by conflicts and failing states in different parts of the world. Now, our starting point was the actual situation in different regions. In large parts of the world, people live in situations of intolerable insecurity. What I call new wars are a mixture of political violence, human rights violations, organized crime, where most violence is committed against civilians. There's a huge gap between actual security needs on the ground and the existence of security apparatuses. We have large numbers of military forces in the world, but they don't actually directly address the security needs of ordinary people in places like Bosnia, Africa, Iraq, and indeed Iraq, one could say, represents a pure example of that. There we see a situation of deep insecurity where military forces are not making things more secure. On the contrary, they may be doing the opposite. So what we were looking at was, what would we actually need if we were to address those real security needs on the ground? And what we've proposed is a human security doctrine for Europe. We're proposing new kinds of forces to be used in new ways. We say human security because we're talking about the security of individuals rather than, although not instead of, the security of states. Nowadays, security isn't derived through the conventional military defense of borders. Instead, if you want to think about what makes individuals secure, it's things like law and order, public security, being able to live in a normal society. So human security usually combines human rights and human development, freedom from fear and freedom from want. Our focus is on freedom from fear. And we use the word doctrine to emphasize that we're talking about how, not why. We're talking about means, not ends. There's been a lot in recent years of discussion about whether humanitarian intervention is justified. We're starting from the point of view that we do have a responsibility to intervene when there are impending humanitarian catastrophes, genocide, for example. But the big issue is how. If we take something like Kosovo, yes, it was necessary to prevent large-scale ethnic cleansing of Kosovars, but was aerial bombardment the best method to do it? So the argument is you really need, the how needs to be in tune with the why. And so what is the why? Well, let me just very briefly say what we're proposing, because I've almost through my time. We're proposing a human security response force. This is what we call it. And that is different from a conventional army. It combines both military and civilians. We've said at least a third of this force should be civilian. That means policemen, humanitarian aid experts, lawyers, accountants, doctors. And we've proposed a force the size roughly equivalent of a division, which is 15,000 people. And one of the reasons why we took this, we wanted to start modestly so you could scale up, but also because it almost exists, and I'm no doubt that Javier Solana will say something about that. If you look at the number of forces, 60,000 committed to the headline goals, and remember that you can only use a certain number at a certain time, and you look at the amount of civilian capabilities committed, 15,000, the building blocks for such a force already exist. It's something that could be easily achieved. And it's completely in step with the development of the European Security and Development Defence Policy. How would it be different from what actually is already happening now? Well, first of all, it would mean an expansion of the civil military planning cell that is under Javier Solana. It would mean that at least 5,000 of those people would be in a state of readiness and would be constantly training and exercising together. And one of the things we really emphasize is that such a force does require a different mindset. Both military and civilians have to think and operate in different ways, and I'll say something more about that in a minute. Second thing, it would involve more emphasis on civilian capabilities. Civilians are notoriously hard to deploy elsewhere because people who are policemen and or doctors or whatever already have their jobs and can't just leave at a moment's notice. So there need to be ways that reserve civilian capabilities are financed and made available. And we emphasize a volunteer element. We propose a human security volunteer force, whereby people mid-career, doctors, policemen, can say, I want to devote 2 years of my life to helping humanity. But there would also be a space for less skilled people. Of course, when we talk about the force, we're really talking about a professional force. But this would be complemented by a volunteer force, which I think would be important to mobilize support for it. So it would also be a space for school leavers and so on. And, of course, I think the name is important. Calling this a human security response force focuses attention on what its role is, what it's for, and I think allows for the possibility of greater public support for what's being done. Now, the other thing we talk about two other things in terms of capabilities. One is that we propose a new set of principles about how you operate, and that's absolutely key to what we do. And we also propose a legal framework. What we're really talking about, when we say we want this force to be used in new ways, not in conventional military ways, we're really talking about using it as a form of law enforcement, trying to provide public security, even though it's military rather than police, or military as well as police, rather than classic war fighting. And that involves a different set of principles about how you operate. We have 7 principles for time reasons. I can't tell you them all, but I'm just going to mention 3 that I think are crucial. One is the primacy of human rights. That's different from in war. It means there can't be a hierarchy of casualties with your own civilians at the top, next your own soldiers, third the civilians on the other side, and last the military on the other side. It means all lives are equal. It means that you can't, you have to take risks in order to save the lives of others. So collateral damage, in a way, is unacceptable. I could talk about this at length, but I'm worried about time. Likewise, terrorists and insurgents are treated as criminals rather than enemies. What it means is your first task is the protection of civilians, and only secondarily defeating an enemy, or in this case, arresting a criminal. Secondly, another very crucial point we make is clear political authority. It's always the case, and it's always been emphasized by the great military strategists, that in operations, politics must be in charge. Politics must decide. But we're saying not only politics is crucial, that every action is judged in political terms, but actually the aim is to create legitimate political authority. The aim is political stabilization, not military victory. And that's a huge difference. What we're saying is, in a situation like Iraq or like Bosnia, what you're trying to do is to create a stable situation so as to find a political solution rather than defeat the enemy, even though you may need to you need to deal with insurgents, but that's how you do that is affected by that aim. And the final thing that we emphasize, which I want to emphasize, is what we call the bottom-up approach. These things only work if you create a situation where local populations can do things themselves. And that means you need widespread consultation of the local population. You need to involve the local population in all kinds of ways. And we do put a particular emphasis on the involvement of women and the role of women as agents of peace in different kinds of conflict zones. Now, we have seven, as I said, and we also propose, in a big way, that if we're going to do these kinds of operations as law enforcement, we need a legal framework under which this force operates. And that's what Christine's going to talk about. I just wanted to make one last point. I think as Europeans, we've continued to allow the US to set the agenda. We always react either for or against what the US does. And we bemoan what the US does or we support it. But actually, I think we have a real responsibility in this current situation to contribute ourselves, to set the agenda ourselves, and really make a contribution to global security. When we talk about human security, we are talking about global security. We are saying that Europeans can only be safe if the world is safe. We are saying that we have a responsibility to, and a self-interest to help people in other parts of the world. We're really talking about how Europe could actually strengthen the United Nations and make a contribution to a new global agenda. Last word.
I'm not going to waste one of my precious minutes walking up to the lectern and taking that time. As Mary, well, first of all, I'd just like to say just what a wonderful honour it was to be on the working group and what a privilege it was to work with all the other members of the working group, some of whom are also in the audience. As Mary indicated, I'm going to talk very briefly about the legal aspects of the human security doctrine. I think as a starting point, it's very clear that the European Union is itself a creation of international law, and commitment to the rule of law is its commitment to the rule of law runs right the way through EU policy, both internally with respect to member states and externally. And so therefore, the working group took the view that the human security doctrine must be rooted in international law. And further, that legal security is itself a component element of human security. So legal security implies such things as legal protection from eviction from your property during conflict, legal protection with respect to personal harms that are committed to you, legal accountability and lack of impunity for those who have committed such harms against you. And so, therefore, the assumption of legal security must also include that those who are acting in authority or control over people within the territory are themselves bound by a legal framework. And this includes people who are intervening from outside the state. So the importance of the force itself, the civilian military force, being bound by legal obligations and operating within a legal enforcement framework. And so, again, as Mary has already indicated, law is at the heart of the working group's recommendations. It comprises two of the principles, two of the seven principles. One's already been mentioned, the centrality of human rights. It also is in the notion of the use of legal instruments to govern and control the activities of the military and civilian force. Further, within the doctrine itself, is the notion that the requirement of a legal framework is itself part of the capabilities, and so is integral to the whole pattern. And that's probably taken three of my minutes. So in the last couple of minutes, I can't possibly go through the various ways in which commitment to law and commitment to the rule of law imbues the entire report. So what I'll do is just point out two of the areas in which that's the case. First, there's the very complex question about legal authority, with respect to the deployment of the military and civilian force. When can it go to intervene in another territory? And as is well known, the basis of international law with respect to intervention in a foreign state is highly contested, especially in the post-Iraq environment, with many different claims as to when intervention is legally justifiable under international law. And the view of the working group is that the European defense, European security policy can contribute to clarification around these contested areas of international law, and also contribute to progressively developing that law in accordance with principled bases, not just as a knee-jerk reaction to, for example, the latest example of intervention. And so, in particular, if the European Union decides that as part of its security policy, intervention without Security Council authorization is going to be possible, it must set out the criteria for doing so, set it out in narrow and unambiguous language, and thus itself contribute, therefore, to international law on this issue. And the second element is that it is essential that, as part of a legal enforcement framework, the civilian and military forces on the ground are bound and operate in accordance with law. Well, that, of course, is already the case. Forces that are abroad are bound by legal regimes. The problem at present is that they're bound by many legal regimes. For example, they're bound by the domestic law of the state in which they are operating. Forces are bound by their own domestic law of the sending state. They are bound by specific military principles, such as rules of engagement and status of forces agreements. And they are also bound by various regimes of international law, including international human rights law, international humanitarian law, and international criminal law. Now, the problem with all of these different legal regimes is, of course, that they are highly complex. Many members of forces simply do not understand them and do not know which legal regime is applicable. And those who are the subject of such intervention also have no idea about the different legal situations and what legal obligations they can expect of the intervening forces. So again, a large part of our recommendations is that there should be contribution to clarity on these areas. Law should be clarified so as the forces themselves are clear about what legal regime they are operating under, and in accordance with the bottom-up approach, these laws should be made public and available to the members of the state that is subject of the intervention. Further, these should be made available to them in their own language. There should be accountability mechanisms. There should be codes of conduct, including with respect to sexual conduct vis-a-vis the target population, and that the accountability mechanisms should be accessible and available to that target population. So in a host of detailed ways, which may well require legal specialists working within the context of the military and civilian forces to clarify the legal framework within which they are operating, the whole integral project is to be seen as law enforcement within that territory rather than just application of military force.
Thank you. Now turn to Pavel for his 5 minutes.
Right. Thank you. And fast, yes. So, we have this human security doctrine. There is a good European strategy.
Maybe get and closer still.
Still? I can hear myself.
You're not the only person in the room.
So we've got the strategy. Brussels is serious, and the question is, how serious are and will be the member states? There is a problem. I will say a few words about the 10 new European members. So the question for them is, what forms their attitudes to security, and what are their capabilities? For that, we have to look at their security or strategic culture, as it's called. And secondly, it's useful to look at their position in the transatlantic rift. And then we must not forget their domestic agenda. So these 3 points. First, the strategic culture. This is formed to quite an extent by the history of these nations and states, and is reflected by the historical memory of these people. What comes into that is the memory of the birth of these independent states. Most of them were new creations in the early 20th century, with some historical memory, of course, of old medieval states. Then, crucially, the World War II experience and horror. Thirdly, the Soviet and Russian, let's say, as it's perceived now, occupation. And lastly, a transition and enlargement process, which they were going through in the last 10 years. That is about NATO and the EU. So what does it tell us? The result of that is that there's a special sensitivity still vis-a-vis Russia. These people are not very enthusiastic about utopias and grand projects. West European powers to them appear to be controversial. Generally, the Central and East European states are pro-Atlantic at the moment, but they are not belligerent. They don't really like wars. Therefore, the result of this is that at the moment NATO is ahead in the mind of these states and peoples, and the EU runs with a certain handicap. There is an interesting moment in that there is a process of socialization of these states that has been going on during the process of integration or, let's say, enlargement. Interesting because those people, bureaucrats, the military, politicians, who were in contact with the NATO enlargement, operate and think in their own compartment. And those who have been with the EU enlargement operate in their own compartment. So that makes a difference. And they kind of clash. What is also true is that there is an illusion that there has been no change of NATO and the EU. But we do know that the change has been great. And I don't know if there will be time in the discussion, but that leads to the fact that these states still are oriented to NATO as it was in 1990, 94, and so on. They still perceive NATO as the security umbrella and a security need for their own security. So NATO is not there as it was, the EU is not, and also the notion of the West is not the same as it used to be. So all that is important, and the consequences for this in the Central and East European states is that progressively these states have become and are further becoming providers rather than receivers of security. So that NATO is not there in the same role. And on the other hand, the EU is moving towards military relevance, at least I believe. What is the possible security role for these countries? Where they are best are areas like the Balkans, East Europe further to the east, like Belarus, Ukraine, and that kind of area. And in their own security, they're doing peacekeeping, stabilizing, helping to change. They're using their experience from transition, human rights, democracy, democratic opposition, and so on. And also civil emergencies. They have their interesting experiences with huge floods they had, and these were emergencies that are, in a technical sense and in a human sense, quite important. All this fits far better with the EU than with the tasks of NATO. Poland is an exception. Poland's in a special position because of its size in that region and because it's been chosen by the US for a different role. This brings me to one special thing, and that is Central and East European realism. So the romantic moment of 1989 to 91 is gone. That's history. Today, as I said before, no grand utopias, but instead pragmatism. You have domestic petty, which I would say normal, politics. That's taken over. And questions like where's the money? How to deal with public opinion? That was important, for instance, in the issue of Kosovo or Iraq. And elections matter. So I'm nearing the end. Should the European security strategy and a European force become a real thing, then its magnetism will grow even for these countries. However, a Baltic foreign minister said not so long ago, when he was reflecting on all this, I will quote, "It would be great if Europe would become a serious military power. So we go along with these ideas. But it won't." So let's stop kidding ourselves. That's these new countries.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be in once again in this London School of Economics to talk about issues that, as I see, interest the students. I wanted to say that I'm very happy to see Tony Giddens, Professor Giddens, here with me again. I thought he would be forever the director of the London School of Economics, but he has chosen to take a vacation. But he will be back. He will be back. Mary Calder, which Professor Calder, a good friend for many, many years. And the other two members of the panel, which I would like to talk about what they have said, if I have the time. Now, let me say very clearly a few things, and then to give time to have a discussion, if you wish to have the discussion. Let me start by saying that the European Union is an organization composed of 25 countries. that if we consider that as a country, we will have twice the population of the United States of America, four times the population of Japan, to put to places in which currencies have importance, that we have a currency, that we are the most important trade partner in the world, that we are about a little bit less than 30% of the GDP of the world, and that we are the most important donor of humanitarian aid in the world collectively. Now the question is, can an institution like that, can the European Union close their eyes to what is happening in the world? The answer is no. It will be unfair, it will be very unjust with the rest of the world if a group of countries with that capabilities, in principle, will not take the stability, the security, and development of the world seriously. And therefore, we have decided to take it seriously. And when I said that, Mary said that we have written this called security strategy of the European Union, we said these things very seriously, that we want to be an important actor in international arena. In international affairs, Europe, historically, has been the scenario. The two great wars happen in Europe. Now, the wars do not happen in Europe, and whatever other places do happen wars, we try to see if we can help to bring peace. Let me say from the very beginning that the European Union, to answer that foreign minister from a Baltic country, is not in the business of going to war. The European Union is having capabilities, military capabilities, not to go to war, but to make peace, which is a very different story. We are not a European Union countries going to go into a war under the banner of the European Union under the command of Javier Solana. This will not take place. It will take place. It will take place, and is taking place at this very moment, is that in very many places in the world, people from the European Union in uniform and people of the European Union in non-uniform, civilian people, are trying to help to bring peace in places where, unfortunately, is war now, and there is no peace, or places where there is conflict of any nature, as Mary has said, of human security type of problems, and we are trying to help them be solved. So what we are trying to do, and we are getting capabilities, is for that type of mission. So we are in the business of solving crises and to handle crises and to manage crises. And crises occur, unfortunately, in this world with the frequency that probably some years ago we didn't expect it to take place. There are many crises, crises that which are in the neighborhood of the European Union and crises which are far away from the European Union, but also take place in the neighborhood of the European Union. I arrived last night, I think about 2 o'clock at night, to this beautiful city of London, and I was coming from Skopje, Macedonia, where on Sunday they have a referendum, very important referendum to stabilize the country after a diplomatic action led by the European Union, after a military action led by the European Union, after a police action led by the European Union take place in the last few years. And on Sunday the final referendum took place, and that country today will not be part of the conflicting countries of the Balkans, but will be part of the problems of the countries which are part of the solution and not part of the problem. To cooperate with that, it has been, without any doubt, the effort of the European Union collectively, the members of the European Union, the member states, and the citizens of the European Union who have sustained with their taxpayers' money this operation. I would like to say then that in the business we are is in the business of crisis management. And as Mary has said, and I'm very happy that she has said so clearly, because when we started thinking about these issues was with Tony and with Murray after the lecture that I gave here in the other theater under lunch, we thought about how we could be useful in that respect. And I think that is very, very important what Murray has said about this cooperation, which is fundamental in crisis management, between the military component and the civilian component. The European Union is probably the only organization in the world now that has already in itself, within itself, the capability of planning and acting together, military and civilian. So we have all the capabilities of the spectrum, from military activity diplomacy, economic aid, judiciary, etc., to the humanitarian aid. All the spectrum of activity vis-à-vis the possibility of helping a country, we have it in the South, the European Union. Therefore, we are very well prepared for that, for crisis management. And we are very well prepared now, more than a few years ago, because we have constructed, as I said before, a planning cell, so an instrument of doing the planning, which is already military and civilian. Imagine that most of the conflict that we have had, or most of the difficulty that we have had in solving conflicts, is because the military started, and by the time that the civilian arrived to do the second part of the business, the civilians were not prepared, they were not packed together, and they were conceived together. Now, from the European Union, we can begin to conceive an operation with all the elements inside from the very beginning. Military action if it's necessary, judicial action if it's necessary, civilian action if it's necessary, police action if it's necessary. From the very beginning, that would be thought. Imagine for a moment some of the conflicts that are every day in the newspapers and every day on the television. Think in any of them and think what would have been the difference if those who were responsible for solving that conflict would have thought from the very beginning not only on the military component of the conflict but also what comes after the military component. And this is the important thing. The conflicts of today are not wars in the classical sense. So they have these phases, which are the military part, that may be the first, and the civilian part that should come just along with the military in order to solve the problems which are left behind. And you have, I'm sure, you are thinking about the conflict that is taking place now, for instance, and in Iraq, where if the situation would have done, the thinking would have been done differently or putting together all the phases of the conflict, probably we will be in a different situation today than what we are. So it's very important then that this civilian and military component of any potential conflict is thought and is planned together. Now, it's very important, therefore, that the civilian components that includes police, includes judges, includes doctors, includes many other type of people, and the military do get along well. And for that, we need a change in our culture. A change in the culture of the military, and I'm very happy now that you have running this operation commanders, which have been doing also civilian tasks, and I can tell you that they have done it, and people in the civilian that respect what the military are doing. And this is fundamental if we want to have the utmost out of this effort collectively of civilians and military. And it's the same for the NGOs. The NGOs, historically, they have a certain lack of respect for what the military are doing and because they think of the military only doing wars. But today, you have military doing not wars, but trying to bring peace. Now, let me go through five examples of where the European Union is now engaged and tell you how and how different they are and what the important things that I would like to underline at the continuation of what I said. In Macedonia, I mentioned it already, and I don't repeat it, but it's very, very important because we have started the negotiation first of the agreement, we have started then the stop of a crisis that came after the negotiation, the diplomatic negotiation. We put the police, we put the military, and we held the referendum. And we are very pleased and very happy to have done that. But we have done also things which are tougher. We have been in Africa, in Ituri, in the part in the western part of Africa, where we have imposed peace, where peace was broken. I remember very well because I was... I received one night a telephone call from Mrs. Kofi Annan saying we have a conflict in this part of Africa. If we don't act rapidly, this may develop into a problem of the type that we have lived in Burundi and Burundi and Rwanda times ago. So he asked, will be the European Union willing and ready to deploy forces to stop the conflict? And I said, yes. And... 3 weeks after that, we had deployed soldiers, 1,500 soldiers, tough soldiers, who had stopped a conflict there, and they were followed by an operation that is still is maintained there, and the situation in Ituri now is one of the places in the Congo which is more secure and more stable. Therefore, we are not only doing things which are soft type of thing, but sometimes we have to do rapidly, in order to prevent the potential crisis to develop. Now, let me go to another one, Bosnia. The 2nd of December of this year, the European Union is going to take the responsibility of the stabilization force in Bosnia-Herzegovina. That means 7,000 soldiers, which together with another 5,000 policemen that we have had already deployed there, is quite an effort for the European Union to stabilize Bosnia. And we're going to do that, and we're going to do it well, and we're going to do it at the level which the conflict in Bosnia is today, which is nothing to do with the conflict of 5 years ago or 3 years ago. The situation is more calm because there has been a lot of work being done there. But in Bosnia-Herzegovina now, the European Union has all the responsibilities in order to stabilize the country. From the military, we have the police there, we are in charge of the juridical system, we are in charge of the reconstruction of the country, we are in charge by through the High Representative, Mrs. Patty Ashton, another important citizen from this country, known by many of you, which is responsible of maintaining the civilian component of the operation there. But let me also tell you that we do other things, which is cooperating with other organizations. And I would like to underline one, because to me it's very important. As you know, in Africa, there are many problems. And in the Africa, the Africans have decided, led by one of the most important countries, beginning South Africa, to organize what they call the African Union, which eventually they may dream to have something like the European Union through the African Union. As you know, in Sudan, there is a big problem. In Darfur, continues to be a problem. There are negotiations which are not still finished. What we are doing now is, instead of acting directly to the European Union, we are giving to the African Union the capability so that they act. They prefer to do it themselves. They want to do it themselves and to prove that they can put do the operation in Africa by themselves, but they need the help of the European Union. And therefore, the European Union is doing training, preparing, doing logistics, doing the giving them logistics and help in order for them to run the operation. Therefore, we are also cooperating with other organizations of the world that want to have the same objective that we do have. When they don't have the necessary means, we try to provide them and help them on doing that. And the last example I would say, which is a very simple one, but very useful. You remember that in Georgia, not long ago, was what was called at that time the Rose Revolution. And it was a change of power in Georgia, in the Caucasus. And at that time, President Saakashvili had a good number of problems, in particular on the, what we may call rule of law. And the European Union deployed a strictly civilian mission of rule of law, which is organizing the country there in this aspect, which are fundamental if they want to get law and order, if they want to get investment, if they want to want the possibility to be in a stable. So I have given to you five examples, real examples, which are happening now as we talk, in real time, of things, activities, actions that the European Union will be doing in the world as an actor for peace, not as an actor of war. Or for war. And that is the spirit in which we are trying to work among ourselves, and this is the spirit in which the European Union countries, member states, are trying to work among themselves. Now, let me finish by saying that on crisis management, we have sometimes the impression that things happen very rapidly. And it's not the case. Our American friends, sometimes they get up in the morning and they look at the problems of the world. They say, I've solved A, I solved B, I solved C. This is not the way. The way is to really put a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of money on these questions and these problems if we want to resolve. Bosnia-Herzegovina is a good example. In 1995, the first forces were deployed, peacekeeping forces, to Bosnia-Herzegovina. 1995. In the year 2005, the end of 2004, it's still 7,000 soldiers are going to be maintained in Bosnia and Herzegovina. So it's a long time, a long period of time. So when we enter into this type of operation, we have to be prepared to maintain and to sustain until the stability of the country is guaranteed. That brings me to the one question in which I disagree with Mary Calder. Disagree slightly. I disagree with the concept of bottom-up, if I understand properly what he means in the paper, and I do understand. I mean, bottom-up is a very nice expression and very lovely expression for these times. But in cases of conflict, the bottom-up is not so easy to do it. If bottom-up means to support the people which are on the ground, natives of the country in which we're acting, yes. But as you know, many of you may know, and she knows, it's very difficult to choose who to support in a conflict. Sometimes it's very difficult to choose who are the ones that we have to choose to go bottom-up. So that may another phase later on in which the bottom-up scheme is the one which is appropriate, the moment of reconstruction of the country, etc., etc., etc. But it has to be a moment in which top-down is absolutely fundamental. Top-down means a change of command, civilian and military. Top-down means that somebody takes decisions rapidly, because to do rapidity in decision-making is fundamental if you want to bring peace. Therefore, I agree with the bottom-up at a certain moment of the development of the crisis, but there are other moments of the development of the crisis in which the top-down approach is much more important than the bottom-up approach. Without negating that the bottom-up approach, there is a moment, in particular in peacetime, which is the normal one and is what we have to use. Now let me in order to be fair, on the not to to disagree only with Mary, let me disagree with the other two, very nicely. And now, I agree with all the questions of legality, completely. And the document that I wrote on those issues, the question of legality is very clear. But we have to be sure, and we have to defend, when we defend multilateralism, that's what we defend, and multilateralism at the end is defend the core of multilateral institutions within the United Nations, we have to add to the word multilateralism efficient multilateralism. We cannot let the situations evolve in a negative manner because the multilateral institution does not act. Now, the panel which Kofi Annan has appointed to give us a response to these questions in the month of December, I have been meeting with them on several occasions, they have very clear this idea. Though this idea of multilateralism together with the word efficiency is going to be one of the core directions of that panel in order to add to this legality question this term of efficiency, which is absolutely necessary. In humanitarian operations, for instance, you cannot sometimes wait when you see a catastrophe or a genocide taking place. And if you wait until you have all the blessing from all the institutions, by the time that you receive them, so many people have died and so many people have suffered that we have to see how we can solve that contradiction of legality and the rhythm at which you have to stop problems which are there. And the people, you, if you are looking at your own television one day, and I am supposed to continue in the job that I have, I hope not. And if you tell me, if you look at that, you will say, God, where is these people? Why don't they act? Why don't they stop that? And I cannot answer because I don't have the legal formula still to do it. I think do it and then ask for the formula. It's probably what is sometimes the manner in which you have to act. And it's very brutal to say like that, but if you are one of the ones which is suffering, probably he would be very grateful to the fact that you have not waited. Now, the important thing is that this is done in the context of real situation which is needed. if you do it the opposite, you have use of these things to justify what is not justifiable, I agree completely with you. So I disagree in that part and not in the other. So I'm very, very fair in the disagreement. Now, to my good friend, Dr. Pavel, he has said something that struck me very much. At the end of the day, he has said, the new members of the European Union, the 10 new members, de facto are members of NATO. And by the way, they are members of the European Union. Well, I think this is a very unfair statement, because if those countries are now at the level of development that they have, if those countries do have the structures of democracy that they have, probably it's much more for the help, the aid, the mechanisms, the relationship that they have with the European Union, with NATO. I think the European Union has been an instrument of regime change, peacefully, the most important that I know. How many changes had been produced, how many regime changes, society changes had taken place because they wanted to adapt their legislation, their way of life, their penal codes, etc., 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 to those of the European Union. Therefore, to a certain extent, I agree that the question of security for you, for your country, is very important, but the changes that have been produced in the societies have been produced also by the mechanism that the European Union has put forward and for the relation that these countries have established with the European Union. I had many more things to say, but I will stop here. Thank you very much.
Just before we open up for discussion, I'll give each of the panelists 1 minute to just respond very briefly, if they want to the criticism. Pavel, do you want to say anything?
Oh, well, if you give me the chance, I have to use it.
Yeah, but not at great length, because we need the audience also to speak.
I was talking about perceptions. That's quite important.
I was talking about perception, too.
Yeah.
That's
so, undeniably, the European Union has done so much that it's there. It's just there. The perception of that is a different thing, and especially in the issue of security. Security is something that tends to be attached to NATO.
Well, the floor is now open for questions. I think we'll take questions, three questions at a time. They can be addressed to any or all of the members of the panel. That is always assuming there are three questions. Well, there do seem to be. Maybe you on the outer.
Thank you.
Ask for brief questions, if you would, rather than statements.
Yes. Does the environment that you envisage with this report and what you've said suggest that the United States is no longer alone in regarding the United Nations as past its sell-by date?
Take the person right at the back at the top there. If you'd speak up, be obliged. Hold the microphone in the right place, etc.
Shara Ali. I have a question for Javier Solana, which I'm sure even the bottom-up Merrick Holder wouldn't dare to ask, which is really, what democratic mandate do you take yourself to have to be receiving telephone calls in the middle of the night from Kofi Annan and then to be calling the shots like that? It's a deadly serious question.
Thank you. One more. In the front at the top.
Mr. Solana's example started with Macedonia, and I'm coming from Macedonia.
Can you just speak up a bit?
Sorry. I come from Macedonia, and since the very first example Mr. Solana mentioned has been related to these events that were happening there, my question is the following. The referendum in Macedonia failed, and that is a very positive outcome of the tensions there. but in a large extent that referendum failed after the fact that the United States recognized Macedonia under the constitutional name. That happened just a few days before the referendum itself. So the question is, what is the European Union's contribution to the success of the failure of the referendum?
If you take just one more, I think you want to draw something.
I just wanted to ask what this human security doctrine would mean for the conflict in the Middle East with regard especially to Palestine and Israel, and how it would affect the European policy with regards to that conflict. Thank you.
Now, thank you very much. We have, I think I have four questions. I will try to give four answers. I'm sorry, I cannot call you by your name because I don't know your name. But, I mean, my friend with the bluish shirt. I mean, it's a very beautiful phrase, but you have made it. I'm sorry. It's a beautiful phrase, but you have just coined that is absolutely wrong. For us, the United Nations is the core of the system of the multilateral world. And we prefer to live in a world with rules that, based on rules, that with a world which is not based on rules. But there are moments in which, for reasons, happens very, not very often, even the Secretary General of the United Nations, with the consent or not consent of the, of his good judgment, thinks that an operation is necessary to be taken, and it hasn't taken time to get the Security Council to take a decision. And that has happened not very many times, but sometimes has happened. And what he does normally, the Secretary General, at the end of having taken that decision, is to make a statement, convene the Security Council, etc. And normally, the Security Council assumes the responsibility to say, which you did, okay. And for the moment, I don't know any moment in which the Security Council has said to the Secretary General, you didn't do it rightly, because that has happened in very few occasions. What I want to leave is the door open for something like that to happen. If we close the possibility of doing that, I think we will commit a mistake. And we will see in the coming days, in December, when the panel of the people that the Secretary General has appointed, that one of the debates, more important debates and conclusions, will be around this question. This humanitarian intervention, for instance, has to be very rapid and things of that nature. But of course, you will not hear other countries, as you have mentioned, to talk as highly as I'm speaking from the United Nations and from his Secretary General.
Now, if I might say so, I think the question was also, you seemed a bit dismissive of international law. And you seem to say, we'll just step in and then we look for legitimacy afterwards. But that's arguably, obviously, what the Americans did in Iraq. And where do you,
no.
I presume, the point?
Well, I think that is what is true is that you may be in complicated waters. One that is possible, one this is legitimate. This is the type of thing in which we have to have the response of the panel address this question in a very clear manner. But I am talking basically about humanitarian moments in which that has been a reality or a need, not when you have millions of days or thousands of days to think and to prepare and all that. And I don't think that in that case is the same type of case as the one I am arguing today. I think at least that is what I'm saying. But I think that it's possible to have that always in the context of the UN and not outside the UN. The second question from the top, when Mr. Kofi Annan called me, he was already at that time had the Security Council blessing for making the call. At that time, what happened is that Mr. Kofi Annan did not have. They have not found the troops, the countries ready to do that. And what he asked is, has asked to me, and others probably asked also, but we said yes, the European Union said yes, and we did it. and he was very happy to do it. But he, at that time, the resolution was already taken, the position of the Security Council was already taken. So Mr. Kofi Annan was talking with that authority. Who took the responsibility in the European Union? In the European Union, I didn't take the responsibility. I convened the European Council, which is, the, as you know, the meeting of the Prime Minister of his representatives, and they decided, yes, we want to do it. Go ahead, do the planning, and let's go. And in a week and a half, we were there. But that is the two levels of legitimacy. The first from the Secretary General, and then the second from the leaders of the European Union, the 25, at that time, 25 already, members of the European Union. The third of Macedonia. It is to say that the change of position about the relation between the Albanians and the Macedonians that was at stake in the referendum has been solved, because a decision on the name that affects fundamentally the Slav part of the society is an interpretation that I cannot take. It may have an impact, but is to take the people of Macedonia, the very low intellectual, if that is the reason that why this referendum failed. The referendum was failing way before the day that the decision was taken by the American administration. There was, by the way, 2 days after the elections, President Bush was elected. I think that if you look at the tendency, at the polls and everything, the situation of losing the referendum was way before. And as you know very well, that referendum has been won, because the Albanians wanted not to participate in the referendum, because the referendum was a weapon against the Albanians. And as you know very well, the Albanians did not participate in the referendum. And I don't think that the Albanians were so concerned about the name of the country. Therefore, I think that some of the applauses were not deserved. On the Middle East, it's very difficult to speak of the Middle East today and at this very moment. At a moment in which the chairman Arafat, the president of the Palestinian people, is about to pass away. I have the hope, having been, as I've been in the last few days, I mean, I've been engaged in the Middle East since the Madrid conference in the 90s, but in the last few days very much engaged with the leaders of the future leaders of Palestine, with those who are in Paris, those who are still in Ramallah, practically talking every day, 3 or 4 times with them. I have the impression, honestly impression, that these leaders are going to be able to act responsibly, to create stability in the country, in the territories, and that we have now a fantastic new opportunity also for relaunching the peace process. And I hope that the intelligence of everybody, including the intelligence of the Palestinian leaders, Israel, the international community, particularly the United States and the European Union, will try to do the utmost that this the loss of the life of Arafat will mean that the people of Palestine will have a reality, will make a reality, the dream of having a state, secure state with secure borders, living side by side with Israel. To that effect, we are going to work from the European Union as much as we can to obtain that. And I think this is the best message that we can send at this moment, at this very moment, at this time, 7:45 in London, to the people of Palestine, which are suffering now the possible death of his leader.
Can we have some more questions? Please. I need to take the mic.
Yes, I'd like to extend the question that was asked above about the democratic accountability question, because it seems to me there's still a conflict between the commitment to human security and international law that, and this is a question for Mr. Solana, but as well as Professor Chinkin, which is that there is a severe conflict between the commitment to human security and the rule of law. I think all of the panelists supported the intervention in Kosovo, but it did not receive UN Security Council authorization. And it seems to me that it's precisely in situations of humanitarian crisis when law seems to be an impediment to protecting human security. Now, Mr. Solana suggests the solution is you ask for legitimacy ex post. you intervene and then ask for legal theory. But who are you asking? Who are you asking for to authorize this intervention? It doesn't seem to be the objects of intervention. And Mr. Solana also suggested sometimes this is excessive. Who decides that this was a mistake? Is it the people, is it the objects of intervention, or some international body?
Hello, Sophia Hoffman from Global Agenda magazine. Thanks a lot for your presentations. I've got two questions. The first one is to Mr. Solana and Mary Caldor. How does the idea of preventive engagement that you outlined differ from the American doctrine of preemption? And the second one is really very related to the other questions regarding legitimacy, and it is whether you envisage an autonomous European defense force taking action without legitimation of the UN Security Council.
Thanks. A quick question on Afghanistan. Are you satisfied with the role that the European Union has played in Afghanistan in general? I think there are many Afghan political actors who would have liked to have seen the EU emerge as a much stronger counterweight to what's perceived as a very partial American presence. Secondly, should or could the EU seek to challenge the current situation where, rather than being indicted as they might have been in Bosnia-Herzegovina, people alleged to have committed war crimes are actually running for political office? And on the same topic, do you foresee a time when all the vast amount of money that's been spent on security sector reform in Afghanistan is going to result in actually restraining people now committing human rights abuses, particularly against women? And just a last quick question. Can we envisage, if the current situation between Serbia and Montenegro really doesn't work out for either side, independence for Montenegro in the future?
Thank you. And one last question from up there.
My quick question is that we've been talking tonight about European can you hear me? Okay, sorry. About I guess mobilizing a European Union military force as a response to a rapid action crisis within the international community. But I just wanted to talk about how clearly there seems to be a lacking of the European electorate or the European people within the European community of a military force, and how can the European Union go about building a, let's say, volunteer or volunteer military or civilian force without a clear backing of the European electorate, without a clear support from the European electorate?
Thank you. I think I'll turn to Christine and Mary, then come back to Javier Solana.
Right. Well, I'd better come in defense of international law. I see the issues around the criteria for intervention as, in fact, contributing to efficient multilateralism. It seems to me very much that the problems at the moment, particularly to go to the comment about intervention in Kosovo, which, in fact, I did not defend. I was one of the people that argued for its illegality and get very concerned about ex post facto legitimacy type aspects. But I think that the problems there were that, one, we have the charter framework, but then we have a big gap with respect to other exceptions to the prohibition against use of force within the charter. And that, therefore, leads to ad hoc, selective, different applications, and also the inefficiency, because there are all these debates that arise at those particular times. And I think that one of the important points, particularly if we are envisaging that the EU forces may be used outside the Security Council framework. I mean, if the Security Council authorizes or requests, then obviously the issue of legality is dealt with. So that's part of the contribution to overall rule of law and efficiency. I would say that the EU should work out in advance what are these appropriate criteria. Okay, they can be worked out giving some sort of flexibility, but at the very least, then it stops the enormous politicizing that occurs at the particular time when there is no accepted clear-cut criteria outside the charter framework. And I think that would be an enormous contribution and a contribution to efficiency as well as to legality. And also, I do think that in terms of acceptance by other states, the legitimacy that is gained by working with pre-decided criteria is also extremely important.
Yeah, I agree very much with what Christine said. I was a member of the Kosovo Commission, and we concluded that the conflict was illegal but legitimate, and that there was a huge problem when you have a gap between legality and legitimacy, and that it needed to be closed in the ways that Christine suggested. And I think that's what we meant, is that we put that into the report. I just want to mention a couple of other things. I'll leave preventive engagement for Javier Solana, but I just wanted to reply on the bottom-up point. Of course, not when we had this discussion in Barcelona, Javier Solana was talking about the wrong bottoms, amidst much laughter. But of course, not all the local population are goody, and how do you know who are the goodies and who are the baddies? I think the point that we wanted to make was there must be a consultation process that goes beyond the leaders. There is a tendency on the part of the international community to talk to either political leaders or to warring parties, and they're often not the ones who are capable of making peace. Even if they are the ones who have to make peace, you need to involve all kinds of other people to make sure it really reflects the concerns of the local population. And of course, it's very difficult to know who are the local populations who are serious about peace and who are not, but you just need to have as wide a consultation as possible. And that's a particular reason why we emphasize women, because we think women's groups are more likely to be the right people to talk to than other groups. And, you know, the advice of the local population may very well be top down. I think that's the case in Bosnia. I don't agree with those people who say there ought to be more local ownership, because the way Bosnia is now, more local ownership means handing over to extreme nationalists. So that's not what I mean. What I mean is that you need to involve as many people as possible beyond the leadership by bottom up. And the other thing I wanted to say was something about European political support. Actually, we, in doing this report, we looked at polling data, and we found that European foreign policy was one of the most popular aspects of the European Union. And I think that if Europe took a stronger position in the world, that would actually help to make the whole European Union a more popular project. Now, one of the things we were deeply concerned about was this idea, which is very popular, that Europe is a peace project, that Europe started to prevent, the European Union was a project that began in the eyes of the founders to prevent another war in Europe. And then it got a new lease of life during the Cold War by people who wanted to end the Cold War division of Europe. So this idea is quite a strong idea. We thought about calling this a peace force, and one of the reasons why we called it a human security force was that peacekeeping tends to be associated with very passive forces, and we wanted to be clear that to do human security, which means to create peace and to really support people, you need to be robust. And somehow it seemed to us that between war fighting and peacekeeping, there was something in the middle, which is law enforcement. And that can really be described as human security.
I quite agree with the two responses have been given. But the question of legitimacy and legality is a question that is in the hearts, in the minds of everybody who has responsibility now. And we have a certain gap that we have to fill. And until the gap is not completely filled, we will be always on some kind of troubled waters about that. But the important thing is that for us Europeans, our intent is to maintain as much as possible the centrality of the United Nations, because it's for us the center of gravity of the multilateral world. Therefore, on this debate, we are not going to act in a crazy manner until we have a real solution to this debate. But it will take time for this debate about legality and legitimacy to be solved. I hope very much that in December, when the people that have been appointed by the Secretary General, Kofi Annan, that has that have, one of the missions they have is to give, or to try to give an answer to that question, I think we will be in much better, much better form, and I hope that that will be possible to have that answer and, in the month of December, at least a preliminary answer. The second question is about Afghanistan. The European Union is not militarily present in Afghanistan. We have to make that clear. The European Union is only present in Afghanistan as an agent of reconstruction, spending lots of money from all the taxpayers of the European Union trying to reconstruct Afghanistan. But we are not, as the European Union, militarily engaged. NATO is engaged, the United States are engaged. NATO entered in the peacekeeping part when the war was over, and the American forces are still there. But the European Union as such is not present militarily in Afghanistan. Now, on the international tribunal, for Afghanistan, as you know, there's not a special international tribunal. For the Balkans, yes. And therefore, we have an obligation to of result, because that tribunal was created specifically for Rwanda and Burundi and for the Balkans, not for Afghanistan. Therefore, the rules that should apply the international is the international tribunal, which has been created globally, but you know that countries which are participating in Afghanistan, they do not accept that that tribunal as a tribunal from the international community. But therefore, it's a difference between the Balkans that has a specific tribunal created by the Security Council than in the case of Afghanistan. I hope that all the people that commit crimes against humanity are put under a fair place where to have a fair trial. Once in the Balkans will be the international tribunal specific for the Balkans, another the international tribunal that was signed in Rome not long ago in order to have the capability of judging crimes against humanity. The last question about the voluntary people for this human security, the notion of voluntary action. We would like very much the idea of the concept of voluntary action. But you ask about the consultation of the European citizens about that. Now, we're going to consult the European Union on many of these things when they have to answer the question about the ratification of the Constitution. Many of the things we have been discussing here, they are going to take shape, legal shape, in the Constitution of the European Union. In several countries it will be a referendum, in other countries it will be parliamentary ratification. But this is the manner in which we think the legitimacy can be obtained for many of these things that we are talking about. Because we have, even in the Constitution, go beyond some of the things that we are talking here. For instance, a clause of solidarity among all the 25 states, which we have not talked about today, is in the Constitution. Therefore, this is the moment in which the consultation to the people should be made, and the people, I hope, that will participate, they will respond, and they will respond positively, because the Constitution is a much better situation than the one we have today. So I hope that in the UK will be a tremendous success, the referendum on the Constitution. I want to insist once again what Mary Calder has said. I mean, before the ratification of the Constitution, the polls, the Eurobarometer, which is the polls that we do every month, the question to number one now that has more support in the European Union is the question of the common foreign and security policy. It's accepted and agreed and, by big majority, big huge majorities of the citizens of the European Union. Therefore, we think that what we are doing has the legitimacy, at least for the polls. If by referendums or by parliaments, that will have to be in the referendum, in the approval of the Constitution. Thank you very much.
I'm really sorry, everybody. We've got to draw to a close. Can I just ask the audience a favour? Would you please stay in your place for a minute or two after we've finished to let Dr. Solana and Mary leave, because like everyone who runs the world, Dr. Solana's on a very tight schedule and we need to get him on to his next engagement. In the meantime, could I just ask you to
thank Javier Solana and the others on the panel for what I thought was a really lively, interesting discussion.